We are beginning the Conference Committee on Higher Education, and want to welcome all of you to this evening, and apologize for being a little late, but that's how this works. So we want to begin, I think, tonight by having the fiscal staff go through the financial spreadsheet, as we're now seeing it.
Mr. Chair, I assume members all have, and I think the audience has a document that is labeled 205 Higher Education Session Higher Education Budget Status Conference Agreement. I'll go through this pretty quickly and just highlight the changes. I'll start out by saying the total expenditure in 2006-2007 for higher education out of the general fund is $2,761,000,000. Starting with the first page, which is HESO, I guess I'm going to mostly go down and highlight the differences that members and the audience will note. There are a couple of items in the difference column that you will see that I should mention. There are some administrative changes that the HESO had asked for in the finance department, and Mr. Albright and I agreed to just clear out some administrative costs out of programmatic issues and put them up in their agency administration. Those show up as change items, but they really aren't substantive changes. And so, for instance, the first difference you see in financial aid services just reflects removing the Midwest Higher Education Compact dues from that line and sending it out separately. And the next one down you see is us adding administrative costs into agency administration from other programs. So those changes you can ignore. The substantive ones start with other small programs. The House accepted the Senate positions on adding $30,000 to the Post-Secondary Service Learning Program and $482,000 to the ICAP program. Moving down to the financial aid lines, which are starting with the negative 12,570 and to the end of the page, again, within the plan that the governor, the House, and the Senate all had to spend the same amount in financial aid as the current base of the program, the changes that the conferees agreed to are the second line, $1,110,000 to change the deadline for application to 30 days from the start of a term. Going down to the bottom group, an increase in the four-year caps at 2.5% per year, a reduction in the two-year caps by a 5% amount in the first year and an additional 2% in the second year, and an increase of the LME of $145 in the first year, and that holds level throughout the biennium. A provision that is connected with that shows up later in the bill is the Senate provision, which would allocate surpluses in the state grant program to LME increases in the second year of the biennium. That's the financial aid. Moving on to the second page of the document, the Senate agreed to the House and Governor's position on the accountability measurement system. Both sides have the state grant software rewrite. The Rochester campus development money is in it, the full $3.2 million that the House had. The House accepted the Senate's position on the United Family Practice Residency Program, and the Senate's position on the increase in the Midwest Higher Education Compact dues. Moving down to other small programs, we have increased the child care grant amount, and there will also be an attendant increase in the amount that a grantee can receive. Also, I should note in that line, as I said before, we moved some administrative costs out of that program and into the administrative costs section of the spreadsheet at the top of the page. That's no net change. It just changes where we show the administrative costs. The series of reductions there, the next few are gubernatorial recommendations to reduce the Interstate Tuition Reciprocity Program and the Learning Network of Minnesota. And then there's an administrative change again as well in the College Savings Plan and the Learning Network as well, where we've moved administrative costs to a different area. But again, no net change. Then we both had the increase in the HESO's private career school licensing fees. The total change at HESO from base is negative $594,000. And again, the aid program, the grant program, has the same amount in the next 2 years as it has in the current two, with some increased eligibility. At the Mayo Foundation, there were no differences between the House, Senate, or Governor, so there are no changes there. Moving on to MNSCU, at both MNSCU and the University of Minnesota, the funding level is at the Governor's recommendation. And you will see that the only fence items, as we referred to them, are the Centers of Excellence money and the competitive salaries money. Then moving on to the university, again, we're at the Governor's funding level, and the only fenced items are the competitive compensation item at the university as well. Other new funds at both the university and MNSCU are in simply in new initiatives, and the systems would have considerable discretion on how to use those. There are no changes to the university specials, and the House did accept the Senate's position on the Department of Health Nursing Education Loan Repayment Program. And then I would only note that the conference target for TALES was $30 million higher than the current, the 2006-2007 target, so we hit exactly on our tail of $2,791,000,000. And since members have asked me, relative to the Governor's numbers they had heard before on what is new money at the university or MNSCU, that amount is $107.5 million at MNSCU and $105.635 million at the university. Mr. Chairman, I don't know if Mr. Albright has any other things he would like to note on that, but that's kind of the summary.
Mr. Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The only other thing I would note is that within the MNSCU and the University of Minnesota appropriations, that the ongoing enrollment adjustment is funded for both institutions, $72 million for MNSCU and $30.776 million for the University of Minnesota.
Do members have any questions of Mr. Byrd or Mr. Albright? Senator Pappas?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Byrd, how much the TALES are $20 million over the Governor, and how is that $20 million then divided? Is that simple enough to tell me?
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, just one moment. The TALES at HESO are only about $150,000 higher than the Governor. No, excuse me. They're about $10 million higher than the Governor. The change item I was looking at. $10 million higher than the Governor at HESO because
of the state grant.
Yes, we have eligibility move into the second year at the state grant.
So we spend $10 million in the state grant.
Yeah,
okay.
They are the same at Mayo. They are about $5 million, a little more than $5.5 million, almost million higher than the governor at Minsky. And they are about $5 million higher at the university.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions from the members? I would just have to just add a comment that I really don't know what we do without our fiscal analysts. They really do wonderful work. And if they say it's good, I guess...
it's good.
It's good. That's right. But if there are no comments or questions of our fiscal staff, then I would like to move to adopt the spreadsheet. Any representative comments?
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. I do have an amendment I guess I'd like the committee to look at that Ms. Novak prepared. I don't know if you want to do
doesn't
that
have,
now.
Have to do with the spreadsheet?
Only because there's some adjustments in it.
Okay, Representative Cox, we need to actually take action on the motion first, and then we can take the and listen to your amendment.
All right.
Mr. Chairman, would you like me to make the motion?
On the spreadsheet, sure. Go ahead.
I would. I guess the House works to make the motion, so it's the fourth. So I would move that the conference committee adopt the spreadsheet in Article 1.
Okay. Any discussion? Hearing none. All in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. And that is done. The spreadsheet is adopted. Representative Cox.
Thank you. I had Ms. Novak prepare an amendment. I hope she has it there, because you don't have it before you, and I only brought a marked-up copy. So let me check in just a second here, if that's all right.
Oh.
There we go. Okay. I just had, Ms. Norwick, I just had my marked-up copy, and I figured I better not make copies of that earlier. So if we can send that around. As it's going around, Mr. Chair, the amendment that I would ask the committee to look at does three things. It reduces the tuition and fee maximum for the four-year programs to current law. I believe it's 89, 83 right now, and we just leave it there for first and second year. And then it would also reduce the lifting and miscellaneous expense to current law, 5205. And then taking those funds, it would move the assigned student responsibility from the 46% back down to the 45%. Now you should have it out before you. And I believe in talking with Mr. Berg, and you could maybe have Mr. Berg address that, but it then would have some, doing these provisions would have a few million dollars left over. And the way I understand that the bill's put together, overages would effectively then just be applied to the living and miscellaneous expense in the second year. So those savings that might be realized would end up going to the second year living and miscellaneous. And Mr. Chair, maybe Mr. Berg could address it and see if I've got it right.
Representative Cox, I think we need to officially move the amendment to get it on the table.
Okay. I would move that amendment, the KN58.
Okay. Mr. Burke.
Mr. Chair, members, Representative Cox is correct. He would make the changes that he noted, and the student share would take about $14 million, and the changes he makes would reduce the expenditure in the grant program by a little closer to $18 million. The surplus would be left in the grant program, and under the surplus language that's in the language part of the document that you're going to get into, that would get applied to the LME in the second year of the biennium.
So Mr. Chair, effectively this would help the public students that are going to college here, their assigned responsibility would drop back down to the House position that we had earlier at the 45% level, and essentially holding the other recognitions in LME to current law. So I don't know. I wasn't here on earlier whether that got talked about, you know, so I thought I would bring this before you.
Okay. Any questions of Representative Cox?
Mr. Chairman, I think there were a couple goals that we were looking for in the state grant, and because we didn't have extra money, I think we wanted to address a couple issues that were problems. One is the four-year cap. One is maybe a two-year tuition maximum that's gotten too high, but we didn't want to bring it down too extreme or too quickly. And flexibility. And a flexibility and a tool that approach that really helps all students. And so the discussion was that the living and miscellaneous expense really helps all students regardless of the sector, and it's very flexible because we can adjust it based on what we needed on the bottom line, and we adjusted it to be a $145 increase. And it is the mechanism we're using to deal with any surplus, as Representative Cox said. So that was the nice thing about the flexibility. I think the problem when we looked at the student responsibility reduction is it was just very expensive. It was $14 million. And it seemed like that took up a lot of the money. And we did really want to change the deadline from 15 to 30 days, which, according to your calculation, you do have some money on the bottom mm-hmm. to do that.
You're right, Mr. Chair. There would,
Representative Cox.
According to Mr. Berg's calculation, there would be enough to fund the extension, I believe, the way you've booked that. Mr. Berg, what was that, the extension?
Mr. Berg.
You mean the deadline?
The deadline,
yeah.
Excuse me.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cox, yeah. There's $1.1 million in for the deadline change, which your amendment does not affect, and it would continue to go forward.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And Mr. Chair, the big thing here, I think, is I looked at this, and I think the policy of, you know, trying to adjust this student responsibility down to that 45% level, I do like that, but I think probably everybody understands where it is. And
anyone else have a question? Then I presume we're ready to vote.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair.
Senator Tomasoni.
I see the student share goes down to 45%. That's on the spreadsheet at 45%.
I think it's zero. It's on the spreadsheet, but I believe it's zero if you look to the right.
All the way across, okay.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. We had it, but your new spreadsheet, it listed at zero because we didn't do it. But it was in there, and now I'm talking about it again.
And then how does this actually affect money going to students then? Less, more, same, what's the effect?
Mr. Chair,
Representative Cox, who wants to explain?
Mr. Fuller.
Could you restate your question?
Mr. Fuller,
I'm just trying to figure out how does Representative Cox's amendment affect the money available for students as opposed to the way that is in the spreadsheet.
Well, it affects students by every student up to the max will get 1% more. So the more tuition you pay, the more you'll get on this program. So it will give more money to those who have a more expensive cost of education.
Even
so proportionally, you'll give less to those, say, for instance, at Minsky rather than at a more expensive college.
Senator Tomasoni, is that cleared up for you?
And what are the numbers we've got? 5250, and
current student share.
You're right, Mr. Chair, and Senator Tomasoni. The living and miscellaneous expense in the amendment that I brought out stays at the 5205. So that doesn't change. We're not recognizing any more on that. And it's reducing it's keeping it as current law, the four-year recognition on the tuition at 89-83. That's where we are right now. So those two things basically just stay the way they are. And then we drop the student responsibility recognition from 46 to 45.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator.
Mr. Chairman Pappas. Mr. Chairman, I'm going to oppose the amendment by my good friend, Representative Cox. If we had more money, I would be happy to do this. Mm-hmm. You know, if we were spending $40 or $50 million more on the state grant program. But I think that to take most of the money to do the student responsibility shift, which mostly helps students at the expensive colleges, I just don't think is fair to do with this small amount of money. Mm-hmm. That's why I like the living in miscellaneous, because it, you know, all students benefit equally.
Mm-hmm. Representative Opetz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The other concern that I think we need to be aware of is that, if I understand what the University of Minnesota has said, is that if we adopt this amendment, we would not be keeping the four-year cap at a level that is at least as high as the anticipated tuition expected at the University of Minnesota in the second year, and that would be an unprecedented situation where the cap is lower than the tuition at at the University of Minnesota, at one of our public institutions. That would be a concern we need to make sure we're aware of.
Okay, are we ready to vote? Okay, all of those in favor of the KN 58 or 58 amendment, say aye.
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 Those opposed?
No.
No.
Okay, the amendment is not adopted.
Good try.
Now, moving on.
No.
Okay. All right. We now would like to move the A23 document, which basically is our language. Mm. Would you like to move that also, Senator Pappas?
Are we going to have staff with you?
Yes.
Oh.
Yes.
I move the A23 amendment.
Okay.
We have that?
If you all have a copy in front of you, we'd like to have Kathy Novak kind of walk through this for us, and you're welcome to ask questions as we go.
Novak? Mr. Chairman and members, on the A23 amendment, sections 1 and 2 are House provisions that eliminate the instructional base that's used in funding public post-secondary education with the delayed effective date. Each section is delayed until June 30th, 2007. On page 2, this is the doctoral authority for MNSU institutions to offer doctoral degrees, applied doctoral degrees. This was adopted by the conference committee in amendment when the conference committee last met. Section 4 on page 3 is a Senate provision that provides tuition assistance to deaf students who are eligible for a Pell Grant or a state grant. Section 5 is part of the MNSU technical bill. The next several sections deal with the scholarship that's funded through the sale of license plates. Section 6 is the same. Section 7 is also the scholarship. These were in the House bill, but they were part of the MNSU technical proposals. Section 8 is also a MNSU provision. It was changes the way that senior citizens are charged for fees when they, actually it clarifies how they're charged when they enroll in post-secondary courses. Section 9 is also related to the senior citizen thing. This was in the House bill, but the Senate also had a bill that was introduced on it. Section 10, beginning on page 5 and going to the top of page 6, was similar in both bills. I believe this is actually the Senate's version of the language, and it deals with the Higher Education Advisory Council. Section 11 is the student portion of the Advisory Council. This provision was in both the Senate and the House. The House repealed the role of the students in recommending candidates for membership of the advisory committee. This provision actually has some compromise language in it that allows the students to veto, the SAC group to veto students that are selected for advisory committees by the director. It would take a four-member vote to disapprove of any appointment. Section 13 was in the Senate, but it is a technical provision that extends the life of advisory groups. Section 14 was in the House bill, and it was presented to the conference committee. This deals with reciprocity and requires the Higher Education Services Office to do an annual report on reciprocity. Section 15 was also part of that amendment that was presented to the conference committee, and it encourages HESO to consider developing data collection procedures to evaluate or monitor reciprocity participation. Section 16 on the top of page 9 clarifies the language on the requirement that students who apply for a state grant have to be current with court-ordered child and support payments. It was in both the House and the Senate. Section 17 was also identical in both the House and the Senate, and it clarifies the definition of fees for the state grant program. Section 10 is a Senate-only provision. It allocates any surplus appropriation to the state grant program back into the grant program to change the miscellaneous living and miscellaneous expense allowance. Some new language is added to expire it on June 30th, 2007. Section 10 was identical in both the House and the Senate.
Wait a minute.
I'm sorry. Page 10. Oh. Section 19. Oh. I was just checking to see. Section 19, beginning on page 10, was identical in both the House and the Senate. It extends eligibility for a state grant for a student who withdraws for active military service. Section 13 was a Senate provision that extends the deadline for applying for a state grant from 14 to 30 days. Section 21 was a House provision. The provision as it appears in this document actually is amended with some language that has been agreed to by the interested institutions. It allows, or it requires eligible institutions to report data on student enrollment and financial aid to the Higher Education Services Office. The Senate actually had a similar provision that looked at distributional and aggregate data, and that language is included on lines 30 to 35. The next section was again identical in both bills with the language that's in here. It expands eligibility for the child care grant program to students who are in active military service for an additional semester. Section 23 is a similar data provision. It was in both the House and the Senate, but somewhat differently, and this is a combination of the two with some additional agreed to language. And this data provision applies to loan programs administered by HESO. Section 13 defines eligible students for the purposes of the loan program. It was identical in both the House and the Senate. Section 25 on page 13 is the Income Contingent Loan or GRIP program. This is putting it in statute. It was identical in both the House and the Senate. Section 26 is the Loan Capital Fund, a new fund created by the Higher Education Services Office. It, too, is identical in both bills. Section 27 is a Senate provision. It codifies the Intervention for College Attendance Program. Section, that goes over to page 16. And section 28 is identical in both bills. It changes the date by which student groups must make their recommendations for members of the Board of Trustees. Section 29 to the top of page 24 makes technical and conforming changes to the Minnesota College Savings Plan. These were primarily identical in both the House and the Senate. The differences were technical and have been resolved in this document. On page 24, section 45 is the changes to the region's election process in statute. The House and the Senate both had provisions that changed the region's election process. This was included in an amendment that was presented to the conference committee the last time we met and was adopted by the conference committee. It makes the Region Candidate Advisory Council advisory to the governor. It creates a joint committee of the legislature to consider the recommendations of the governor, and it provides for an election by the legislature and joint convention. On page 26, this was a House-only provision. Representative Severson's provision to provide some protections for disabled military veterans who are attending post-secondary education. This has some clarifying language on lines 25 to 28 on page 26 that makes it clear that if a disabled veteran has to withdraw for any medical condition, the protections in this section are available to that veteran. Section 28, page 28, section 49, again, extend, and section 50 on page 29, extend eligibility for the Peace Officer Survivor Grant for students who withdraw for active military service. It was identical in both the House and the Senate. Section 51 is the farmer lender extension. It was identical. The Senate's language was identical to a bill that passed the House. Section 52 was a House, Subdivision 1 was a House-only provision. It was included in the amendment that was presented to the Conference Committee at the last meeting. It encourages the Higher Education Services Office, or requires them to negotiate with South Dakota on the feasibility of initiating interstate payments. Subdivision 2 deals with the interstate reciprocity agreement between Wisconsin and Minnesota, and was in similar language, although not identical, was in both the House and the Senate bills. I believe this is the House version of the language. Section 53 is an advisory task force on public post-secondary funding. Both the House and the Senate had similar versions of this. This is the version that was in the House bill. It excludes legislative staff on the advisory task force. Section 54 is a House provision. This is an alternative format instructional material network requiring CISO to convene a group to look into providing alternative instructional material in an electronic format. This language has been worked out by interested groups that include some representation of the Association of American Publishers and representatives of private and public post-secondary education. Section 55 is a retroactive effective date for the extension of one semester of eligibility for those who withdraw from military service. It was identical in both bills. Section 56 is changes the name CISO to the Higher Education Services Office, or the Higher Education Services Office, to the Minnesota Office of Higher Education. It was identical in both bills. The repealers in Section 57 were identical in both bills. Article 3 is a private career schools article. This was primarily identical in both bills, and we adopted the bulk of this when we adopted the identical provisions. The one different section was the on page 45, section 20. It was the regulation of private and out-of-state post-secondary institutions working group that requires CISO to convene a group to review the regulation of private institutions. This version in the bill before you is the House's version of that language, and the principal difference is that legislative staff are excluded from the working group. Article 4 of the bill is the Rochester Education Development. This is the Senate version of the bill with just a couple of changes. And the principal difference is that it doesn't have an endowment and it doesn't exempt, it has no exemptions from data practices or open meetings. It also on page 47, line 2, makes the Commissioner of Finance a non-voting member of the committee at the suggestion of the Higher Education Services Office. And I believe that is it.
Questions? Representative Katz.
You probably went right over it and I missed it. I apologize. The language that you and I had discussed earlier about reviewing the for-profit. Oh, never mind.
Is that in an amendment?
Okay. Yeah. Mr. Chair and
Ms. Novak.
Representative Opetz, because we don't have the language for Article 1 in front of us, it's proposed to be incorporated as an amendment to Article 1.
Thank you.
Okay, are there questions of Ms. Novak or this document before we get to amendments? Okay. Which amendment are we going to begin with? The OPATS amendment? Since yeah, it's being handed out. Thank you.
you want me to talk to it first? I'll move it.
Yeah, Representative Lopez, could you move your amendment?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will move the KN-59 amendment. Members, the House position that significantly reduced the two-year private college cap, I think it's fair to say, engendered a very good and healthy discussion about an area of student financial aid that we really, at least as I recall in my history here, haven't really spent a lot of time looking at. While the House's provision was modified significantly in the bill, and instead of what I think was about a 38% reduction in that two-year college cap, in this bill is a much more modest total of 7% reduction in the cap over the 2 years. One of the things we discussed, or I guess we realized, is that as the legislative body, we really need to know more about the relationship between how we're providing financial assistance to for-profit schools, how their tuition is affecting students, student borrowing, and all of that. So what this language does is incorporate a provision requiring the Higher Education Services Office to do a study that examines tuition levels and program offerings, debt load, and a number of other variables, and report back to us to help us better understand the for-profit sector in the higher education marketplace.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you. And, Representative Lopez, I'll support your amendment. I think it's something we do need to look at. It isn't something that the Senate spent a lot of time on this year, but we're certainly, I think, open to learning more all the time, and getting information gathered and presented to us is always going to be very helpful.
You want to pull your microphone down there? And there we go.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Olpetz, you mentioned in the amendment for-profit secondary education sector. Would this include the internet-type institutions, learning over the internet?
Representative Olpetz?
That's a good question, Senator Kerlin. I'm not sure. Maybe I'll refer to staff on that.
Ms. Novak, do you have an answer?
Mr. Chairman, I believe it could include the some of the internet providers if they're licensed in Minnesota.
Senator Pilling, any additional follow-up?
A possibility. Maybe it should say post-secondary educational institutions licensed in Minnesota.
Representative Pence.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Kerlin, that seems reasonable to me. I don't know if does that expand it in any way we should be concerned about, or I don't know if we want to hear from Ms. Hegard or Hiso on that, but I would be open to that amendment.
We do have a response. Please identify yourself, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Trisha Grimes. I work for the Higher Education Services Office. The language that would be most complete and would fit with the other statutes would be to say institutions licensed or registered in Minnesota. Licensed would be under Minnesota Statutes 136A. No, registered would be under 136A and licensed would be under Chapter 141.
Representative Lopez, you want to incorporate that?
Mr. Chair, I would incorporate that. I think it would be on line 6 after education sector, and then it would say licensed or registered in Minnesota, in the state. Does that work?
Ms. Novak, does that work?
Mr. Chairman, yes. I believe a sentence would then read, the Higher Education Services Office must study the for-profit post-secondary education sector licensed or registered in Minnesota.
That's it. Mm-hmm. Okay. Any other questions? If not, all those in favor of the Amendment 59, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, I have the amendments on the accountability section in the side-by-side, A21 and
A22. I know this is a serious meeting, but did anyone bring a radio? How are the twins doing? Apparently, nobody.
For those of you who don't know, the chair keeps us well informed on the House floor through email about the status of the twins' score, although some of us have found it interesting, Mr. Chair, that you only seem to be, and I may
when
have this wrong, we only seem to get the emails when the twins are leading.
And once I declared the game over.
Yes, and it turned out not to be true.
I know they didn't listen.
Can we make sure that Ms. Seabart gets this too? Mr. Chairman,
Senator Pappas.
I actually consulted with Senator Kelly to just tighten up some of the language and or be more specific on some of the language in the accountability sections on the spread on the side by side R5 and R24 is where the language
which,
is.
Which amendment are you offering first?
A21 is on R5.
Okay, I'm not sure if everyone has copies in the audience.
I wanted to make one change on the A21. Mr. Chairman, and that on line 6 is to change recommendations to report.
And you'll just incorporate that?
I'll incorporate that, yeah. So the rider language would read, 100,000 in the first year, 300,000 in the second year is for the Higher Education Services Office to develop and implement a process to measure and report on the effectiveness of post-secondary institutions in the state. And then we insert and make a report. Isn't that redundant? They already said measure and report on. No. All right, and make a report to the legislature regarding the implementation of the process. The report must be made by January 15, 2006 to the legislative committees with jurisdiction over higher education policy and finance. That's the A21.
Any questions on this amendment? Hearing none, all those in favor of the A21 amendment say aye.
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 Aye. Opposed? Nay? I didn't really oppose that.
Nay.
I said no.
Mr. Chairman.
So that is adopted. And then the next amendment?
The A22. Is on the spreadsheet, the side-by-side R24, the House language, amending the House language, on page, on 21 and, I don't know how you call it, page 20, line 1 and 2, reinstate the stricken language, and then add, delete, after the word 2, trying to understand it. So, collecting and maintaining student enrollment and financial aid data and reporting data on students in post-secondary institutions to develop and implement a process to measure and report on the effectiveness of post-secondary institutions. And Ms. Higar, did you see this language? Okay. That's okay? Then I'll move the A22 amendment.
Any questions? Okay, we're rolling along. All those in favor?
Okay.
Ready to vote? Mm-hmm. Okay. All those in favor of the A22 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
And those opposed, say nay. A22 amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chairman,
mm-hmm.
Mr. Fuller tells me that I need to move to adopt
Section 10
on page R24. in the adopted into the conference committee report.
Okay. Everyone, Ms. Novak, do you have that?
Mr. Chair, yes. I know.
Do you want to restate your motion?
Mr. Chairman, I move that the conference committee adopt section 10 of the House language on page R24.
Any questions?
As amended by the A22 amendment.
Okay, good.
Okay.
Okay. All those in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Adopted.
Okay. I have another amendment.
Okay. This is the A27.
A27? Is that right? Okay. The A27. Oh. Mr. Chairman, I've actually been working a little bit with Mr. Miller on this, and it's the codification of the guidelines for the ICAP program. And the Senate had a proposal, and the House had a proposal. And we consulted with Mary Lou Presbach at CISO, and so we made a little changes to the House proposal. But it ends up being an amendment to the Senate language? Okay. We're amending the document. Okay. Document, page 14. All right. Mr. Chairman, we're amending the A23 amendment.
Okay. With the A27 amendment.
Right. Okay. And maybe Ms. Weidman could explain it.
I can just briefly go through it. I think the concern that was expressed, the main concern was offering the ICAP services. I think in the initial language it said elementary and secondary students, and we wanted to limit it to students in grades 6 through 12. So the amendment on page 14, line 18, we would delete everything after underserved. On line 19, after students, we would insert in grades 6 through 12. On line 32, we had academic enrichment activities in there twice. So we would, after the semicolon, line 32, insert and on line 33, delete everything after counseling and insert a period. And then at the bottom of page 14, delete lines 34 to 36 and insert, this was another idea from the House, grants shall be awarded to post-secondary institutions, professional organizations, community-based organizations, or others as deemed appropriate. And the grants would be awarded for 1 year and could be renewed for a second year. Then on page 15, we would delete lines 1 and 2. Line 4, again, would make the change that these programs would be available to students in grades 6 through 12. Line 17... we'd delete distribute grants and insert support projects. On line 23, after served, we would, or before the semicolon, we'd insert reflective of the needs for services listed in subdivision 1. Then at the bottom of the page, we would delete lines 33 and 34. And on page 16, delete elementary and secondary education and insert school districts.
Any questions on the A27 amendment? Representative Cox.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If, just to understand it, the changes made in the A27, HESO would be able to award a grant for a two-year grant, but they would review it and see that there's achieving or progress made towards achieving successful program outcomes. So kind of measure it, and if it's not, then you might lose your grant. But if you're on track to doing what you said you were going to do, then you could expect to get the grant.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cox, that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Twins are ahead 3-2. Any other questions?
Mr. Chairman, is that why you have such big screens in the House hearing room?
Yeah.
So you can watch the game?
That's right. Okay, if there are no questions, all those in favor of the H-27 amendment, say aye.
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 Aye. Opposed, say nay.
Mm-hmm.
I'm on a roll here, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, you are.
I have an amendment.
Oh, I'll let. Do you want to go next?
Okay. Senator Tomasoni.
I have an H-24 amendment, Mr. Chairman.
It's being handed out?
Yeah. Oh, she's handing it out. Mr. Chairman, this is the second part of the 14-day deadline extension to the 30 days, and what this does is that it allows the kids that in 2003 to 2005 that missed the 14-day deadline but were within the 30-day deadline to reapply. And I think it's a fairness issue, and I think it's actually will be pretty easy for the department to figure out, because my intention would be is that that the department would not have to be looking for people who fit this criteria, rather that whoever fits the criteria would have to actually apply. I think it would be pretty easy to put the notice out about this at the same time in the same place where they put out the notice of the extension of the 14-day deadline, and I think that it can be fit in pretty easily with any remaining money that's available at the end. So I don't anticipate there to be a big number of people, just based on the fact that the awareness factor might be something that is a little bit dubious. And then the other part is that there's another deadline in this one. They have to apply by September 1st of this year. So I think it's something that can be done, and I don't think it'll be much of a problem.
Bob Eastland. Senator Representative Eastland, sorry.
Thank you, bud.
All right.
Senator, I know I talked to you before the meeting, and we talked a little bit about this, but I guess the concern we didn't talk about, and I guess I didn't think about it until just sitting here, is how much do you think it's going to cost, and where's the money going to come from, I guess?
Well, this is only if at the end of the year, there's always money left over in the grant program, because it's really hard to calculate how much there is, and so it would come from whatever's left over there. And it's only if there's money available, so it may or may not cost it.
But no, the way we structured this bill is there shouldn't be any money left in the grant program, is that right? I mean, most of it's going to go back into the...
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pappas.
It's conceivable there could be $100,000 left. Wouldn't be significant. But, you know, so we do have a plan for that, you know, this would be a possibility, and then HESO could transfer it into the child care program, too.
I guess I just have one question.
Senator Eastland.
Mr. Chair, is it going to be an administrative issue here? I guess could HESO maybe make a comment just on,
I believe they are willing,
what this might do for from their perspective?
Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you very much. Mr. Chair and members, my name is Susan Higa. I'm the Director of the Higher Education Services Office, and with me I have Cheryl Maplethorpe. Cheryl's the Director of our Financial Aid Programs at the agency. And we support the extension of the deadline from 15 to 30 days. We have one of the most generous deadlines in the country, but we do support this extension. We understand that there has been some concerns about this. Our concern, however, is adding this retroactive provision. And as I said, we know that there's strong feelings about this, but there would be a fair amount of difficulty that we'd experience administering this piece. And also, I think, at the campus level, there'd be difficulties administering this as well. And I think Ms. Maplethorpe could speak to some of that if you have questions. One of the concerns, you know, what's been discussed here is there's an interest in having us advertise, but then there's also an interest in perhaps not having us advertise. And one of the worries that I have is that we could be sued. You know, if we're treating different students differently, somebody could argue that they haven't had notice, and that puts us into a very difficult position. One of the other concerns that we have is that there actually could be an income tax liability issue for students. The retroactive award could create an income tax liability. The new award could mean that their gift aid could exceed tuition and fees, in which case the excess is taxable income. The new award would also reduce their net tuition, meaning any HOPE credit, if they got one, that's a federal credit, lifetime credit or tuition tax deduction would now be inaccurate. And it could be the legal responsibility of the student to refile their tax return. Ms. Mapplethorpe may have something to add on this, but I guess, we understand that there are some people that might be left out, and that is unfortunate, but I think you have to kind of weigh the benefit and the detriment, and I think for us to administer this would be very, very time-consuming, given a number of other responsibilities that we've been given by you and by the governor.
Mr. Chair. Senator Tomasoni.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Hegarth, how many grants do you give out a year? How many grants do you give out a year?
Around 7,000.
7,000?
70,000.
Mm-hmm. So another 100 is going to cause you all kinds of problems?
Mr. Chair and Representative, or Senator, sorry. It's not that there would be some administrative hassle to this, but I mean, you're right, 100 is nothing compared to 70,000. The one of the ways this would work, though, is that we would have to wait until after the first year of the biennium was over to see if we had enough money.
Yep.
At that point, you're 3 years after the event. They would have missed the deadline 3 years previously, so you'd be paying out money for an event that happened 3 years into history. And also, as Susan mentioned, there would be potentially tax liability. Anyone who applied for a HOPE tax credit or a lifetime learning tax credit would have to recalculate that and show that on their current taxes.
Well, but that's not your concern. That would be the student's concern, and I would think you would be able to put a disclaimer underneath on the application that there's are some potential tax liabilities that you may have to look at when you apply for this. And I think that could just be a part of the application that you do online. I don't see that this would be much of a problem at all. And you will know by September 1st of 2005 how many applications you have and whether or not people will be eligible. So you'll have lots of time. And in some instances, for the students that would have applied in January of 2005, there's only about a year lapse, and so these could be freshmen in college who missed out on a $1,500 grant or something like that, and it could help them immensely in their funding of their tuition. So I don't think the nightmares will be what you think it will be, and I think you'll know the answer to everything by about September 30th of 2005.
Mr. Chair, just one more point, I think, adding to this, is that we may have students who attended schools that have closed. And again, I guess my concern is to what extent do we chase the student? You know, you know, on the one hand, we may just kind of sit and wait for the student to come at us, but I think at some point there's also an obligation for us to try to seek that student out, and we're just concerned about, you know, that obligation. That's part of it as well.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Thomason, it's not your obligation to ask the student to apply for the grant. So it's not your obligation to seek them out to get this money either. I mean, if somebody doesn't apply for a grant, they don't get it. And in this case, they would have to apply for the retroactivity. So it's not your obligation to seek them out. I think it's up to the student to actually apply. Mm-hmm.
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, I mean, Ms. Seeger, couldn't you just put something on your website so students who are checking out your website for information about what they need to do to apply for the grant, they just see a little notice that there's some retroactivity available if they miss their deadline? No, I kind of agree with Senator Tomasoni. I just don't think it seems like that big a deal.
Senator Tomasoni, as I understand it, this is just a one-time.
One time.
I mean, if this would imply if it's on the website that it goes on and on.
After September 1st, they can take it off the website.
So we don't want students to know that it's easy to to correct something if they make a mistake. Representative Cox.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in visiting with Senator Tomasoni, I didn't understand one thing, and that was, and maybe Ms. Hegarth can address that. I thought I heard you say that there could be up to a 3-year lag here, so could you be refunding money to people that have graduated 2 years ago?
Ms. Hegard or whoever?
Yes, Mr. Chair. We would start making payments at the end of the next fiscal year. So in the middle of the next biennium, we would know whether we had enough money to cover both years of the biennium. At that point, we would be making a payment for someone who potentially missed the deadline in September of 2003, mm-hmm. 3 years earlier.
Okay. Thank you.
Any further questions or comments?
Can I just make one more comment? I just want to make sure that, Mr. Chair, that members know that when we first advertised the deadline change, we did a number of things to put these students on notice. So it wasn't sort of like something out of the blue that we did. We put this on the webpage. We had several publications. We had press releases and articles in Metro papers. We had handouts at the state fair. We did extensive communication with aid administrators on campuses. And campuses also publicized the change. So we did really put these folks on notice that the deadline was changing so that it wasn't something that should have been a surprise to most people.
Okay, are we ready to vote? All right. All those in favor of the A24 amendment, say aye.
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 Those opposed, say nay. Nay. Oh. I think we need a show of hands. Just, I didn't hear that clearly. So let's all those in favor of the A24 amendment, with a show of hands. Okay. All those opposed? Good. Judgment call. I mean, it's not a judgment call anymore. The amendment fails.
Mr. Chairman, I have the A19 amendment.
Okay, Senator Pappas. Senator Pappas moves the A19 amendment. Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, while the amendment's being passed out, I think conferees are familiar with this issue. Representative Cox and I authored the provision to define what it means to be a resident for the purpose of paying resident tuition. Unfortunately, the conferees were not able to agree to include this in the conference committee report so far. And I have to say I've been deeply disappointed in kind of the last-minute killing of this proposal. The young organizers and students have worked very hard. They've visited many of us in our districts. They've built bipartisan support in the House and the Senate. And it's for a good cause. It's access to higher education, which we should all be for. It's for the young people so that they can have a future, so that they can have their dreams. You know, it's not really their fault that some issues are tied up in Congress around this. Senator Orrin Hatch has been trying to get this passed for a number of years, again on a bipartisan basis. Both our senators support this provision nationally, both Senator Coleman and Senator Dayton. It's just unfortunate that we're not able to get agreement here today. And, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to invite a couple of the supporters to just come forward for a few minutes and give us a last-minute testimony as to why they think this is important.
Welcome. Thank you for being willing to testify tonight, and if you can identify your name for us, please.
My name is Victor Sanchez, and I, like most of you, am an American. I have been for the past 14 years. I I came to this country when I was 3-4 years old. So this is really the only country I have ever known. And for these past 14 years, adults, teachers, parents, everybody's been telling me you can have and do whatever you want as long as you're willing to work for it. And I did work for it. Just like most people, I work hard in school, I play sports, captain of wrestling team and all that stuff. And recently, a few years ago, I found out that because of reasons that are beyond my control, because of something that I cannot go back and change, which I would give anything to go back and change, I'm not going to be able to have the same opportunities that my friends have or that any of you had growing up. All I really want is the same opportunity as everyone else. I want to have the same chances to go to college and to make something of myself. I don't want to have to work any harder than anyone else, but I am willing to work hard. And I'm just as American as any of you here, and I don't think that if any of you were in my position, you would be opposed to this. So thank you for hearing me out.
Thank you very much. Welcome. Identify for the faith, please.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Grant Stevenson. I'm the pastor at St. Matthew's Lutheran Church, and I'm leader of the Isaiah Clergy and Religious Leaders Caucus. Isaiah is an organization of over 80 congregations in the metropolitan area and in St. Cloud. And we stand with those who stand for the DREAM Act. We are grateful, Senator Pappas and Representative Cox, for your leadership on this. And we're aware of the political position that you've been put in these last 24 hours, and we're angry about that. We're angry that that the rug has been pulled out from under this amendment at this late date. We're here to support this amendment and also to make the case that what we're talking about here, as so many of you know, is really an issue about who we're going to be. It's an issue about morality. It's an issue about how we define ourselves as a people and as a state. And it is about hope and it is about dreams. It's why it's called the DREAM Act. We're concerned that those who are working against this are not acting on dreams and on hope, but rather on fear and what we come to call a myth of scarcity in our state, and a myth of scarcity that's taken over the debate about where we're going as a state. We don't consider the folks like Victor, who just came up and spoke to you, to be foreigners. These are Minnesotans. These are people who live with us, who have been to school with us, and who want to have a future with us, and who are a bright part of our future. But we know that many people do consider folks like Victor foreigners, and if that's your position, even if they are foreigners, the tradition that I speak for, the Jewish, the Judeo-Christian tradition, also has something to say about that. I even brought you, to keep you awake, words from the book of Leviticus. Foreigners living among you should be treated like your own people. Love them as you love yourself, because you yourself have the experience of being foreigners. Well, that is the. I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak, and we want to support the inclusion of this amendment.
Well, thank you very much for testifying tonight, and I think I have to just make a quick comment that I think that this is moving in the right direction. A lot of things here at the legislature move slowly, and I think this is another example of things moving slowly, but at least moving. And as chair of the Higher Education Committee in the House, I can assure you that in the session coming up in 2006, Representative Cox, I believe, intends to bring it back. It'll be given a hearing again in my committee, and this time we intend to move it to the floor, and there will be an opportunity again. So, again, it doesn't satisfy the disappointment, but it does at least, I think, move this. It doesn't kill it. It's still moving. I think that's how I would like to look at it.
Thanks.
Representative Cox.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate your commitment to move this and work with me next session on this. I think it's important that this is the right thing to do. I think we're hearing a number of comments from there's a room full of people here that are I've worked with a lot over the last several months, and they've been great to work with, I want to add. Always there when you need them, and that's not always the case with everybody you work with on every bill. But for a variety of reasons, you heard Pastor Stevenson give you some information on that. We also have a tremendous investment in these students. We educate them in K-12 or 5 through 12 or whenever they're here in our schools, and then they're Minnesotans. And so we have this investment that we put in them, and we need to draw on their abilities, and as long as we've invested that level in there, and I think some of them, not all of them, but some of them I'm sure do and have the ability to go on and be very successful in life and want to do that. And as you heard Victor say, they would like that opportunity to do that. And then I would just also like to say that the demographics of Minnesota, we need these students. We need to have medical technicians and doctors and lawyers and everything as we move forward. And we may not have the traditional student source that we think we have. So I think we need to reach out and be as inclusive as we can in this. It is unfortunate, as Representative Norton said, you know, this is kind of all coming apart, and I think that the children, the students here are probably showing larger adult tendencies than we are maybe sometimes on this, but that they're going to be a group that will miss another year here of opportunity. There's some sitting in here tonight that I think would be in school in the fall if this moved forward, and we'll miss that. But I guess, Chairman Nordness, I would agree with you, and in paraphrasing that new governor out in California, I'll be back.
I would just like to add one more thing to the students. Again, this is a disappointment, I know, but there are still some opportunities, in spite of this little setback. There are some schools that will probably, again, depending on enrollments and so forth, be an avenue for you. So I would urge you to talk to your school counselor and examine all of those possibilities so for this year you might have an alternative. The fact that this isn't going to be moving forward this year. So there are some opportunities that I'm hoping that your school counselor can help you at least identify. Whether it works for you or not, that's another question. So,
Mr.
Chairman, Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, are you talking about some of the Minsky institutions that charge resident tuition
right.
to everyone?
Right.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I was wondering if we could ask Ms. Hegard to come forward and give us the governor's position, and I don't know if she knows the rationale as to why he said he would veto this bill if this provision was included.
Before Representative Lopez, do you have a comment first, or can you go second?
Why don't we?
Okay. Ms. Hegard?
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Susan Hegard of the Higher Education Services Office, and I know that there are strong feelings about this issue on all sides. I think as Representative Nornes so eloquently put it, this is a process. And I want to also acknowledge the hard work by many of the young people who are here this evening. I've seen them at other hearings, and I think it's admirable. Their hard work is admirable, and I give them a lot of credit for this. I think the governor's been clear about this from the very beginning, that he has concerns about this particular legislation. It has not yet become federal law. As we know, it's passed in the United States Senate, but it has not yet become federal law. So there's a process occurring out there as well. And he's indicated that he would not be able to support the higher education bill with this provision included at this time.
Representative Lopez? Okay. Senator Cohen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I appreciate the comments by both yourself and Representative Cox, the work that Representative Cox has done on this, and the promise that, Mr. Chairman, you've made and Representative Cox has made as to a successful conclusion during next year's session. But, Ms. Hegard, you haven't answered the question. So why does the governor oppose this?
I think that there are a number of reasons, Mr. Chair. I have not had the opportunity to speak with him directly at length about this, but my understanding is, you know, from the very beginning he's expressed concerns about it. I could provide you, you know, at another point in time with more detail. As I said, I haven't had a chance yet to sit down with him directly and at length and talk about this.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Cohen.
You know, as I mentioned at the outset of this conference committee, I'm kind of the interloper here since I don't serve on the Senate division, but certainly as chairman of the Finance Committee have worked with Senator Pappas or division members and know that Ms. Hegard, when we restructured the HESOL office in the last couple of years, the intent was to do so to have somebody directly within the governor's cabinet involved with higher education, where previously there had always been that separation. So you're here tonight as the representative of the governor, in the same way that went across the street to the Environment Division, you know, Commissioner Miriam or Commissioner Holston would be here as representative of the governor. So I'm disappointed to hear that you can't offer us any full explanation as to what the reason is that the governor opposes this. And that's particularly true since, and somebody, possibly the pastor, somebody who's been more involved with this than I've been, could confirm for me, I believe that there are a number of states in the country that have adopted this, including a number of states with, I'll suggest, relatively conservative Republican governors. So it's certainly not something ideological in other parts of this country. It's certainly not something partisan in other parts of this country. And that's why I'm mystified as to why this particular governor feels that Senator Pappas indicated would actually veto the higher education bill with the inclusion of this in. I'm just baffled. And we're not getting an answer. So that's actually a pretty good lesson for the students here as to, you know, when politicians take positions and can't answer one way or another. You can't offer us any advice, thoughts, or anything else?
Mr. Chair and Senator Cohen, you know, one of the things that I have heard the governor say is that there's a federal bill, you know, that has passed the Senate. There hasn't yet been a bill passed on the House. And so I think one of the things that he's interested in is seeing something pass at the federal level.
Well, Mr. Chairman, just your comment was that one of the lessons of this place, and having been here for, you know, a number of years, I've certainly learned that there is always next year here, and things don't take place overnight. And so I think your comments in that regard are well taken. But Ms. Hegard, if we're going to wait for the federal government to do something, you know, we'll be here 10 years from now. This place, I mean, one of the things I've liked about the state legislature over the number of years I've served is that you do see some action in issues. You don't see it at the federal level. And I sure hope that the governor's not waiting for federal action on this.
Representative Cox, I mean, Opaz, did you have a comment?
I don't have anything with respect to Ms.
I think probably we're, unless someone else has a question directed at Ms. Hegard. Representative Opaz.
Well, Mr. Chair, I would like to take this opportunity to raise I guess it's a suggestion I've had for a number of years, and this represents another example of, I think, an outdated policy for Minnesota, and that is the issue of non-resident tuition. We have seen copious data in the last few years about the crisis that we'll be facing in Minnesota with respect to workforce, that Minnesota is not going to be producing enough college graduates to meet our workforce needs, and this is another population of potential college students and members of our workforce that we raise this bar, this arbitrary bar of non-resident tuitions. And I just share with you a little bit of information on that. This in some respects relates to other parts of the bill on reciprocity with some of our neighboring states. I just updated some information that I had looked at a while back, but we refer to people who come to Minnesota from other states and other countries, not from reciprocity states, as NARNARs, non-resident, non-reciprocity students. And because of particular interest by institutions within MNSCU, three-fourths of our NARNARs, students from other countries, California, Montana, and students who are not Minnesotans but also not from reciprocity states, three-fourths of those students are already being afforded in-state tuition rates. In other words, institutions like the St. Cloud State, Winona, Moorhead are already making decisions not to charge thousands of outstate non-residents, even from other countries, even non-Americans, are in-state rates. And I did a little investigation even as late as today to find out, well, what would it cost Minnesota to make the decision to reduce that barrier and just say across the board that we would not charge anybody non-resident rates because it would make good public policy for our workforce. And it's an expensive proposition, but really not as expensive as you might think. It would cost about $12 million, and I don't think we can do that now, but I'd like people to think about this, that we could address all of these issues for as small as when we have a $2.7 billion higher education appropriation here for as little as $12 million a year, at least on the MNSCU side, that wouldn't address the University of Minnesota, but I suspect it would, might even be less. We could be saying to the world that we really want to address our workforce needs in the future by inviting those residents from other states to come here. So this just was an opportunity for me to share that this is just one example of, I think, an outdated policy.
Representative Cox, do you have a comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate those comments from Representative Opatz. He and I visited a little bit about this, and you know, the more you look at this issue, there may be more than one way, as my mom used to say, to skin a cat. You know, I think that if you know what you want to do, then I think we can work to get there. But to answer Senator Cohen's issue, I truly believe the governor has an issue with federal policy and getting involved in what may be perceived as immigration and just a whole host of things that way. I know there are states that have this, and obviously that's why we're trying to move it ahead. If everybody doesn't agree with that, then I guess we have issues. But I do want to pick up on something that you said, Chairman Nordness, and that is I do want to work on this next session, and if it's in this form, that's what we'll go forward with. But I do think that we can't make any promises that, you know, if we have a standalone bill, and I apologize to the students here that maybe I should have handled this bill differently. I'm the rookie in this bunch of people here today. If it should have been a standalone bill moving forward and getting the positions firmed up before it comes into here and all that, I don't know. We'll work on that and figure it out, and I appreciate your willingness to do that.
Okay. We have one more student that would like to just take a couple of minutes.
Myself.
Oh, it's not a student. Okay, I thought it was a student. Mike?
Mike Lopez.
Mike Lopez?
Oh, from MNSCU.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh.
Okay.
I didn't know.
I was expecting somebody shorter. Identify yourself, please, for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mike Lopez, and the Office of the Chancellor of Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. I did want to provide some information to the committee. The Board of Trustees at their March 2005 meeting did approve a resolution, and I'll read the resolution to you. The Board of Trustees supports legislation that will allow students who have attended high school in Minnesota for at least 2 years and who have either graduated from a Minnesota high school or attained a GED certificate in Minnesota to qualify for resident tuition rates, provided that this legislation does not conflict with federal laws. And it's my understanding, Mr. Chair, that Senate Counsel has advised that the legislation in this form does not conflict with federal laws.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We will take testimony for one more student. If we have one that can be brief. Okay. I know there's others of you that want to be up there, but we have a little more work to do yet, and it's already 9:15, so please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is Emma Paskowitz.
I represent the 1,500 students at Southwest High School as the student body president-elect for the 2005-2006 school year. I've been involved with various leadership groups since the fifth grade, and when I came to high school, I was excited to meet tons of new people, but I was disappointed that our student council didn't represent the various cultures at our high school. Then in 10th grade when I came in, there were about six Latino students. They are ready to take on leadership roles. And within 48 hours, we were really good friends and already making ideas about how we could integrate our school, how we could bring kids together and teach each other that we, although we are different, we are trying to do the same thing. We all had dreams. We all wanted an education, and we can all work together to do that. I became better friends with them and realized that they are the most intelligent, hardworking, and dedicated people that I've ever met. I started going to meetings with them, and they opened their arms for me and treated me like I was one of them. And later on, I realized that there's one shining difference between us, and that it's that I can go to college, and I have a greater opportunity to do that than they do. And I was just, I can't even begin to explain how I felt. I was so disappointed, and I was really sad. And so I'm here today in front of you as an American citizen, as a student leader at my school, at the district level and at the state level, to tell you that I am in complete support of the Dream Act, and that I just want to say that it's about equal opportunity. It's about dreams. It's about the fact that I deserve and they deserve the same opportunities. And I've learned so much from them. And the main thing is that they've just taught me to keep going no matter how hard life gets. And I'm here to ask for your support to allow them to continue trying and to reach their goals. Thank you for listening, and thank you for your cooperation and your consideration.
Thank you. Thank you for your hard work. And I would only add again that through this, hopefully it's been a learning experience. The students that have been here have been they've been really professional. They've done a good job. So it's not your fault. And we'll be, you know, staying in communication with all of you as we go forward.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to add my support to the students whose goals are the highest of aspirations we would hope for any of our students in the state of Minnesota. I consider it enormously short-sighted that we have to delay this proposition for another day. I hope very much that students who desire higher education will keep that hope alive so that we may find you with a diploma in your hand in the not-too-distant future. All of us who have spent time in higher education or who have seen the benefits of higher education for the state of Minnesota know that it's virtually impossible to support yourself, much less a family, on only a high school diploma in the modern world. And in the global knowledge economy of the 21st century, we cannot afford to waste any talent. We can hardly afford to delay the development of any talent. So I hope that we will move very, very swiftly to deal with what appears to be an impediment to the aspirations of all Minnesota students to get the best possible post-secondary education that might be possible for them. That's our job in the state, to maximize the opportunities for all citizens to help build the future of this really wonderful state.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, yesterday when I heard about the governor's position, I was very disappointed and very angry. And my words at that time were that I was going to offer this amendment, and I wanted us all to vote on it and make our positions clear. But I know that my House colleagues do support this provision in the Senate bill in the A19th Amendment. And because of decisions and positions from the House leadership and the governor, would be forced to vote against it. And I don't want you to do that, because I want you to be able to vote for it. So, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to withdraw the amendment.
and we'll just live to fight another day. And we'll keep working together.
Senator Pappas withdraws the A-19 amendment. Is that right? Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Just one moment, Representative Johnson. I've been handed a note here. Bottom of the eighth, Twins 3. Whoever they're playing is 2. So we're not... So, pardon me for doing that. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to state for the record that I object to the withdrawal of an excellent amendment.
So noted? Okay. Do we have any other amendments?
Two more.
Oh, I have an oral amendment. You're going to move that we're not allowed to talk sports?
You have an oral amendment?
I have an oral amendment.
Okay. Senator Tomasoni.
Why don't we pass out the mayor's amendment?
This amendment will be on page 26 on line 5. Some of you were here and some of you weren't. This is in regards to the selection of the regents for University of Minnesota.
What page?
It's page 26, line 5.
On the amendment? On the 823?
Yes, on the big thing here, on the 823.
Okay.
And what it says there is we've basically turned over our selection authority to the governor by having the committee recommend to the governor, then the governor recommending to the joint committee. And while I had some concerns about that the last time, I still have some concerns about that. But it seems to me that in clause C on line 2, where it says the joint committee may recommend to the joint convention nominees recommended, may only recommend to the joint convention nominees recommended by the governor. And then it says, and if the joint committee does not recommend a nominee of the governor's, the governor must submit a different nominee for the same vacancy. It would seem to me that if two times in a row the joint committee does not approve of the governor's nominations, that at some point the joint committee should be able to make a recommendation to the joint convention. And so my recommendation is that after the period we put, if the joint committee does not recommend a nominee of the governor's, then the joint committee may make a recommendation other than the governor's nominee. And that way, on the third try, the legislature then takes back the power that it's always had. And I don't know why anybody in this room, including Democrats or Republicans, would actually want to give up the ability to make a selection like this. But at this point, if there is a potential logjam between the governor's recommendations and the joint committee's inability to nominate one of the governor's recommendations, the joint committee then has the ability to make its own recommendation. And I would think that's sort of non-controversial because the governor gets two shots at it.
Senator Cohen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Tomasoni's amendment, and Senator Tomasoni has emphasized one side, which is the balance of power between a governor and a legislature. My concern is slightly different. If the legislature has made the attempt to confirm nominees of governor and those nominees are not confirmed, don't we set ourselves up for failure by not allowing an out relative to legislative action down the road? It would seem to me that, as I read this language, that in, I don't know, 98 cases out of 100, a gubernatorial nominee is going to be the person selected to the Board of Regents. But what happens in the event that there is, you know, the one exceptional person that confirmation is simply impossible? And obviously you assume if the nominee fails, the governor nominates somebody else, but what happens if there's just this logjam, hypothetically? So I think Senator Tomasoni's amendment offers the out in the hypothetical, which I think is unlikely, but certainly not impossible to envision, where there simply is not the ability to confirm the particular nominee of the governor.
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Cohen and Senator Tomasoni, the Joint Convention can always nominate someone. So if you had that case of that exceptional person, they could be nominated at the Joint Convention and defeat the slate recommended by the committee.
And that, so that, Madam Chair, is very unlikely that it would happen. And this because what you have in the Joint Committee is you're going to have 10 Democrats and 10 Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
So the potential for a logjam is there. And I think that every one of us here, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, whether the governor's a Democrat or a Republican or an independent, would want to be able to have the ability to make these decisions in the event that the governor's nominee isn't satisfactory to the Joint Committee. And this gives the governor two chances to recommend somebody. And if the Joint Committee doesn't then approve either one of those, you can either go to the floor without any recommendations, and then the floor turns it into a big circus of nominations, and you we're right back at the same spot that we're trying to get away from. Or you can have the Joint Committee figure out who they want and then make a recommendation to the floor based on the Joint Committee's own recommendation. So the governor has two chances to get it right, and if he doesn't get it right on two chances, the Joint Committee will then act.
Senator Tomasoni, there is the advisory council that's going to be sending names to the governor.
Yep.
That should be a fairly well-balanced group of individuals, I think, and they will, you know, do their best to send the best to the governor. He will then do his best to send it to this 10-member panel. And again, it will be a slate of candidates, and I think it's highly unlikely that we're going to go on and on and on to try to find the perfect candidates. So,
Mr. Chairman, have you sat for any of those?
I have. All of them. In the last 9 years, all of them.
And I have too. So anything can happen in those.
So we think this is a compromise that's going to be better than what we've had, and we have discussed it between... We had both authors from the Senate and the House together and with staff, and we hashed this out, and we think that this is at least worth a try. And I understand what you're doing, but I would right now have to say I would oppose this change. Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Tomasoni, I think the situation that you bring up is real. And we did recognize that this may not be a perfect solution, but we're not going to be faced with nominating regents for another 2 years. And so I think probably it would be wiser, rather than to make the amendment now in the conference committee, is to think about it and make the proposal next year in both the committees in the House and the Senate, and have us further refine it next year in preparation for 2007. Is it five this year? Is it five this year?
Yes.
I've lost
so
my
far.
Years
yeah.
for the 2007 regent candidates.
Oh, man.
Then he gives us, you know, I mean, that's why we really wanted to get it down this year, so we could think about it now. We can think about it now for 2 years.
I would concur with the Senator, yeah. Senator Pappas, that this may not be the right time to try to make this little tweak and I'm not sure if you'd agree with that.
I don't, and I'm not sure why any legislator would want to give up any kind of control that you have in this kind of a situation. But
yeah.
Basically speaking, Senator Pappas, this entire thing was done in the conference committee, and this whole agreement was done in the conference committee. While we had some hearings in both the House and the Senate on it, the final product came out of the conference committee,
right.
And I regret having voted for it. But I think that this is something that makes sense, that because we may never, ever, as Senator Cohen said, get to the point where the Joint Committee actually doesn't recommend one or two of the governor's appointees, and I don't think this is endangering the governor's ability to do anything at all.
Can we hear from the House side now?
Of course.
Okay. Representative Cox.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I will say that I think I appreciate Senator Pappas' position. That probably makes some sense to leave things and move forward. But Senator Tomasoni, when you bring up the fact that we have 10 and 10 and we have potential for a logjam, I wonder if it wouldn't be easier to say if after the two failures, the governor just simply appoints it. That's a person of one, and you'd probably get agreement. I'm not sure that if you're having trouble on the on the 10 and 10 deal. Maybe you would have that forever. Maybe we should just give it to the one.
That's going exactly the wrong direction.
Okay. Well, I thought maybe you might.
Representative Eastland.
Mr. Chair, Senator, maybe another way to address it would be to go back on page 24 under subdivision 4 in the bottom of the page here. It says the advisory council shall recommend at least two and not more than four candidates. Maybe the advisory council should recommend four candidates. And then the governor gets two shots, and then the council can decide about the last two, which one they want.
But Mr. Chair,
I mean, just another representative thoughts.
I would still vote for Senator Pappas's idea to leave it and try it.
In other words, oppose the Thomasoni amendment.
No.
Okay. Do we need to vote, or are you
wait till next? I got white shoulders. I want to take a vote.
I want to take a vote. Does everyone understand the motion? Okay, all of those in favor of the Thomasoni motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No.
You do a lousy
job. And it's
two in a row.
You wrote it.
And then you get two more
seconds.
Now we still have. The motion does not prevail.
I have the 826.
Okay, the 826. Is that. Do we have copies of that?
Do we have copies? Yeah, I got it.
Senator Pappas, would you like to move the amendment?
Mr. Chairman, I'll move the A26 amendment.
And we'll wait just a moment till everyone has a copy. Do all the members have copies? The audience perhaps doesn't yet.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Pappas.
I'm going to have Mr. Fuller explain it because it's a little complicated. But basically what we're doing is we're taking the language that was passed out of the Senate Higher Education Policy Committee or Education Policy Committee and referred to the Senate Finance Budget Division, but we did not include in our bill because we didn't include a designation for Centers of Excellence. So since we've agreed to the House provision to designate to spend $10 million in Minsky for Centers of Excellence, we wanted to bring our language then into the conference committee.
Mr. Fuller?
Mr. Chair, members, that's correct. So what we did, because the language is in the Article 1, which is not in the larger document, we amended by stripping out the language on the establishment of Centers of Excellence that's in the House side, and then substitute the Senate language in Senate file. I looked at that. The difference is the Senate language basically includes all the concepts that are in the House language, but you can see it on lines 1.9 and 1.10. It allows flexibility in the number from 3 to 8, whereas I think the House named 6 or 7 areas, and so there's a little more flexibility. The criteria that are different, criteria 1 is pretty much the same. 2 is an addition. You see all sort of refinements. They give more sort of direction about what the legislature is looking for with respect to these Senate elections. So we're looking for a commitment to expand the influences of the Senate to improve results in related programs. That's not directly in the House file. Three, the capacity to improve employment, placement, and income expectations of graduates. Four, five, and six, and seven are essentially in the House file. The House language is eight. Nine is a new one, a strong existing program upon which the proposed center will build, and 10, a separate fund for donations dedicated for the program within current institutional foundations. And then a catch-all that they can adopt additional criteria. So I think it's reflective of the intent in the House file with just a little more refinement and targeting. And then on subdivision three, the same language. It has to be advisory committee and reports and the information flowing. It picks up some of the identical language. It picks up all the identical language in the House file and adds a little bit more. So essentially, it's a refinement that's conceptually similar.
Any questions on the A26 amendment? Ms. Segar, do you have any? No comments? Okay. Okay, it looks like we're going to see an agreement, but we'll find out. All of those in favor of the A26 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Nobody's opposed. Unanimously adopted.
We have an A8 amendment.
Okay, and I believe this is the last amendment?
No, there's one more.
There's one more. Okay. Senator Pappas?
I think one of my staff is going to explain it.
Okay. Do you want to first move the amendment?
Mr. Chairman, I'll move the A8.
Mr. Chair and members, what this amendment does is clarify language regarding HESO's transfer authority, making it clear that the transfers go from the state grant program to other grant programs, the child care grant program, tuition reciprocity, and others, but not the other direction. And it also requires the agency to get written permission from the Department of Finance and to notify the legislative chairs of any transfers they intend to make.
Everyone able to hear and understand this amendment?
I got it. Oh, a new one. Okay.
What are we doing?
This
one. I don't know.
Are we going to give the Jane? Rankin? Jane Rankin, can you come forward and comment on this amendment, please? Do you have a copy of the amendment?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Jane Rankin with the Department of Finance. I'm the budget officer for higher ed. And Mr. Chair and members, what this amendment would do would be to bring the current authority that HESO has to do transfer funds between programs more in line with what other agencies in the executive branch have, where they need to have the Department of Finance approval and notification of the chairs of the Senate and House committees before they make such a transfer. So the Department of Finance is supportive of this language.
Okay, that's what we needed to hear. Any questions on the amendment, the A8 amendment? Hearing none, all those in favor of the A8 amendment, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? And the amendment is adopted.
And I think this is the last one.
Yes. A25, would you like to move that one?
Mr. Pappas? Chairman, I move the A25 amendment. The A25 amendment is, we had a little extra money, so with the child care grant, we're able to move the per award for student maximum award from $2,200 to $2,300. So this is language. This was actually Senator Curlin's bill.
Senator Curlin, do you have any...
Maybe Senator Curlin would like to move it.
Move it. I think it's a great idea.
That's what they like.
He can move.
Yeah. Okay. Senator Curlin, would you like to move the amendment? Then
yep.
We'll vote on it.
So.
Okay. Senator Curlin moves the A25 amendment, and hearing no questions, all those in favor of the A25 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Okay. Now we have to move the adoption of the A23 amendment, which is our main document, as amended, and direct the staff to prepare a conference report. Senator Pappas moves the A23. And, any comments on our basically our final document? Senator Cohen, you had your hand up first.
Go ahead.
Well, Mr. Chairman, there's lots of things I could say. I really enjoyed working with the House Conference Chairman and the staff. I thought we were a really good team. We worked together really well. And I want to say I'm very appreciative of the House's flexibility. I do think that the House proposal on the two-year caps for a 38% cut was a little too extreme. And we recognized the concern and did do a slider cut. 5%, and have the study language, which I think is very good. While I'm certainly still very disappointed about the resident tuition issue, I do think we have a really good bill. I think we have good policy. We've fixed some problems. We have a good amount of money to make up for some of the cuts from 2 years ago. We had good input into our hearings, and I think we've got a good bill here.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Pappas. Senator Cohen.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to make a couple of comments, and they won't be quite as positive, although I appreciate the hard work done, Mr. Chairman, by yourself and your conferees. I know I've been a little bit of the absentee member because I've been spending all my time in the governor's office. And recognize that this bill is a good bill, and certainly, as Senator Pappas has indicated, goes a bit of a distance toward improving on where we were 2 years ago. But it's still a disappointment. I certainly am not naive enough to have felt that coming into this conference committee that we'd come away with the Senate position relative to the funding allowed for this bill. But I was surprised in the negotiations in the governor's office as to how hardline the position was, and particularly of the speaker, not so much the governor. And it's a disappointment because it's been clear to me in the years I've been in the legislature that higher education is always secondary to other considerations. And the speaker made that very, very clear in our negotiations. When we agree on a target for the K-12 bill, I can promise you we will be at a figure that will be higher than the governor's position. There will be other bills that I expect could well be higher than the governor's position. This bill, we are barely over the governor's position. I didn't expect that we would, again, come away with the Senate number. That was just simply not going to be realistic, although I think a very appropriate number. In fact, I was somewhat disappointed in establishing the targets in the Senate that we weren't able to at least in the first go-around, come up with a figure that was at comparable to what the systems had requested. But I was struck in the negotiations by how difficult it was. I thought there'd be a little bit of an opportunity. You know, a lot of talk about the Senate tax bill and should we, you know, will it pass, will it not pass? Putting aside what we ultimately do, I do think some of the discussions underscore, and not, Mr. Chairman, by yourself or by your conferees, but I think the discussions underscore that higher education is still not the priority that it ought to be in this state on the part of its political leadership. So I'm very disappointed in not being able to achieve at least somewhat more of an effort toward amelioration of where we were from 2 years ago. Now, having said that, I do want to acknowledge that the governor's recommended figures were good. They were decent. They should have been better, but I will give the governor credit that at least it's a correction on where we've been going the last couple of years. I do have a particular hope for the governor, and I recognize that one of the things that has made Minnesota's higher education system in the past such an excellent system is that we have both a land-grant system, the University of Minnesota, and the Minsky system, which are both excellent systems and have done a spectacular job. But it's clearly a political reality, and I observed this when I was a member of the State House and far removed from higher education. I've observed this over the years in the Senate, that obviously there is, because of the geographic spread, the simple reality is that the Minsky system has a variety of champions. Historically, the champion for the University of Minnesota has been the governor. And I'm hoping that Governor Pawlenty, since we haven't been a product of the University of Minnesota, will take on the role that I think in the last 50 years has been held by Governor Elmer Anderson, a Republican, Governor Wendell Anderson, a Democrat, and in particular Governor Arne Carlson, a Republican. I think Governor Carlson's second term was clearly a spectacular time for the University of Minnesota. And the only person who can most effectively articulate for the university is the governor. And although I think the governor deserves credit for what he has recommended to this legislature relative to funding, and I do intend to support the conference committee report and the bill on the floor of the Senate, I hope he will take it upon himself to become that much more of a champion of the University of Minnesota, and certainly Minsky as well, as the previous Republican governor.
Senator Thompson.
Mr. Chair, does anybody have a handle on how much tuition will go up as a result of this bill?
I don't think the systems are ready to make an announcement tonight, but I think this is going to go a long ways towards being well under that double digit that people have been talking about. Representative Opass.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think I'd like to echo some of the thoughtful comments from Senate members of the conference committee, but I would like to make just a couple of more pointed concerns about what we're doing here. I too am supportive of the bill. I think it does go a long way to address some of the significant cuts in the last couple of years, but I do think we need to recognize a policy change here that we better be aware of as we go into the future. First of all, at least with respect to Minsky, we have not fully recognized the very significant number of new students into that system, and so the funding on a per student basis is still well below where it used to be. And related to that is the provision in the bill that ends the enrollment adjustment, or recognizing in setting the base for the biennium the enrollment changes, which have been really significant, so many new students coming to the Minsky system at both the two-year and four-year institutions. And that, we really have to think about what that might mean. You can imagine that in 2 or 4 or 6 years, as more students, even more students, might be coming to some of our open enrollment institutions, how leaders in the Minsky system or leaders on our campuses have to think about that open enrollment philosophy that we've had here in the state for so long, when the legislature is saying we're not going to connect the dots between the numbers of students in the system and how we're funding those students. We may find ourselves seeing some institutions talk about having to establish policies that might not necessarily close enrollments, but not be as open as they have been. So I think that's a concern that I have about the bill that we're voting on this evening. And finally, in addition to not fully recognizing the enrollments, even within the Minsky provisions, at least as compared to the University of Minnesota, we're fencing more of the money. We're saying of the appropriation we are handing to the Minsky system, there's still a fairly large amount of that that they can't spread evenly across the system based on enrollments, that they are for some targeted things. So I just as a caution, I think we have to be concerned about what some of these things mean for the future. But again, as I stated when I started, I do think that we're making some progress back to funding the institutions, and I think this bill amounts to perhaps 8.5% or 9% increase. And as Representative Norris indicated, I hope that dampens the significant tuition increases that we've seen in the last few years.
I just want to comment that this is my third year as a member of the Higher Ed Committee, and in my opinion, we've come a long way from the first year, the 2003 session. And so we've made a huge turnaround. This is very positive. I think what I hear from all of the folks out there that we're trying to serve is that it's a good bill. I'm hearing from the university, I'm hearing from Minsky, and I think we'll even hear from the two-year for-profits. We have been hearing from them, but in a different way. They haven't liked some of the things we're doing. I think we'll hear probably a little different story now that this change has happened. But I think everyone in general is okay with what we're doing, and I think maybe okay isn't as good as some people would like, but I think that, and I don't want to bring any politics into this. I think we've done a good job. I appreciate working with the Senate. I think it's been a positive experience. Some of you for the first time, and we used to serve with the Ranger.
We forgot about that.
I know. And I had to oppose you tonight a couple of times, but
you didn't have to.
Okay. Senator Cohen.
Did he have any more success with his amendments than his member of the House than he had tonight? Or no.
Well,
no, but we've always enjoyed working with Senator Thompson.
Mr. Chairman.
Any other? Yes. Senator Thompson.
I'm hearing people say this is a good bill, but I'm reserving judgment on it because I'm not convinced that we're holding down tuitions. And after 60% tuition increases over the last 4 years, I don't know how we can expect the students to take much more burden on. And that was one of the reasons that I wanted to put that retroactive provision in the bill, because students are having so much debt to pay when they get out of school that oftentimes they're having a mortgage when they get out of college and they don't own a home. And I thought we could have done way better in controlling tuitions, and I'm disappointed in the fact that we didn't do more. I'm anxious to find out what the increases are going to be, because I'll be willing to bet they are double digit. And I haven't heard any numbers yet, and I'm going to reserve judgment on whether or not this is a good bill.
I'll just throw out a 5 or 6% number. I won't wager, but we'll see who's right. Any other comments before we actually vote? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Like Senator Cohen, I think back to a time when there was considerably more investment in higher education than we are currently able to do at this moment. I think of higher education as the wellspring of the Minnesota economy. It's rare that a business would ever move to Minnesota or expand because of our great winter climate. But anyone who comes to Minnesota or expands in Minnesota does so because of the extraordinary talented workforce that we have in this state. It's a workforce that is built upon three steps: early childhood and family education, K-12 education, and then the crown jewel of education in Minnesota, our systems of higher education. When we underfund any of these steps of education, we are shortchanging our future. And in the last couple decades, there has been a feeling abroad in the United States, I can remember when I first started hearing it, that because it is the individual who benefits from higher education, the individual should shoulder a greater share of the cost. That has a certain merit, but a limited merit. It is a short-sighted thought to see that only the individual benefits from higher education. We benefit as a society, particularly in the global knowledge economy of the 21st century. We benefit as a society to have a very well-educated citizenry. Some have offered the idea that the very strength of a democracy is a strong, well-educated middle class. And when we deny or curtail opportunity for post-secondary education in the modern world, we are only shortchanging our future. So while we have made significant progress, and I salute that, and I appreciate the leadership of both chairs and both bodies in having moved in that direction, I think we need to redouble our efforts to further the investment in higher education as we move further into the global knowledge economy of the 21st century.
Any other comments? It's only 5 to 10. Well, I want to thank the staff that's really worked hard with us, both sides, Senate and House, and everyone. And we have people we don't see, the folks that are not going to have to go to work tomorrow morning to put this together so we can sign the conference report tomorrow and hopefully be actively voting for it on the floor come Friday. And that's our plan. So,
want me to make the motion?
Yes, Senator Pappas, would you do that, please?
Mr. Chairman, I move...
You don't have to read all of them.
The bottom one? Oh, okay. I don't have to do the middle one?
No.
Oh, we did that. I move to adopt SCH 1385 A23 and SCH 1385 A23 AHD...
As amended.
Oh, as amended, and direct the staff to prepare a conference report.
Okay, thank you very much. Senator Pappas makes the motion. Now let's vote. All those in favor of the A23 amendment, say aye.
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 Opposed? Adopted. Thank you very much. And our meeting is over.